London calling. David here. I've just heard on the BBC news, the radio news, that a 220 million year old dinosaur footprint was discovered on a beach by a 4-year-old girl. She said, "Look, Daddy." Well, when news like that comes in, I get on to Aaron Hunter, our dinosaur hunter. He's a London Walks guide, as well as being a Cambridge University paleontologist and a Blue Badge guide, et cetera, et cetera. And I just know that Aaron will be able to answer a lot of my questions. So good morning, Aaron. Thanks for talking to us.
Good morning, David. Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, well, I've got a few questions, Aaron. How in the world has this thing survived 220 million years?
Well, it's amazing, isn't it? And in fact, it's because that footprint got filled in with sediment, and then it got compacted into a layer of sedimentary rock. And then by, I would say, pure luck of geology, it's sort of been buried deep in the ground, and it stayed down there for 200 million years. So it survived under mountain ranges. The rock has stayed a sedimentary rock. It's not been recycled to metamorphic rock. And then over time, erosion has brought it back to the surface.
That is fantastic. Where does it come on the dinosaur time scale 220 million years ago?
Well, South Wales is actually quite important in the world of dinosaurs, because this is at the beginning of the dinosaur story. So we are dealing with the advent, the appearance of the first dinosaurs over 220 million years ago. So at the time, the world was a huge desert continent called Pangaea, inhabited by giant cow-like reptiles called Cerapsids. And at that time, dinosaurs, as we know them, they wouldn't be that big, appeared on the planet. So this is the beginning of the story, really. And in fact, South Wales and Bristol area, across the channel, the Bristol Channel there, is home to one of the oldest dinosaurs discovered in the history of dinosaur research, which has the very long name Thecodontosaurus. But it is again significant because it's part of those early dinosaurs.
That's great. Did mammals exist at the time?
They did, actually. In fact, amazingly, from what I know, this is 120, and I think actually 110 million years ago is the first mammal. So they would have just about appeared at this time. Now, of course, we have to be careful here, because we have to define what a mammal is, because those giant reptile-like cows I was just talking about, they were kind of mammals, but they were the ancestors of mammals, and they would have laid eggs. But at the time, a very small shrew-like mammal appeared, also laying eggs as well, and that is what we would have seen as mammals. They would have been really tiny and living in burrows.
Did they have anything to fear from dinosaurs?
Well, nothing to fear, because they were hiding in burrows. I think the thing about it is that mammals remained that size for the entire of the dinosaur period.
Huh. Yeah. I suppose there was a danger they could be stepped on, or their burrow could be stepped on.
They could have been definitely stepped on. I think the fact is that they were hiding away. Dinosaurs really ruled the roost. They were the kings of millions of years at that time.
Yeah. The BBC report said paleontologists think they'll be able to get an idea how this creature moved just from this one footprint. So how will they be able to do that? What will they be able to find out from that one footprint?
Well, We are lucky enough to have a very good researcher in the vet school in Hertfordshire, Professor Hutchinson, and he has done a lot of fantastic research on dinosaur biomechanics. So he's actually gained this from being able to look at how horses walk and run, and trot. And so what he's done, and also ostriches as well, because dinosaurs were kind of birds, so they would have looked probably more walked more like an ostrich. And so for that reason, they were able then to look at how they move. And dinosaur footprints are interesting because what they do is they provide an idea of the space between the footprint and the weight of the animal. So because this is soft mud, you can see how deep the track has gone down, how many tracks there are, the size of the track, and the size of the animal. And from that, we can use mathematics to calculate the size, the weight, the speed of the animal, which means that Professor Hutchinson has actually calculated the speed of your T-Rex that you saw in your Jurassic Park in 1993.
That's interesting. What is the speed of the T-Rex? It's fast, isn't
Not as fast as the film, but still pretty fast.
Okay, all right. Do they know yet? Was this this footprint? Did it belong to a? Was it a full-grown dinosaur or a youngster or?
I believe it's full grown. They say
Right.
that it belongs to a species called Coelophysis. And so that was, but it's difficult to tell because we don't know the maker of the footprint. So it could be a juvenile version of a larger species. What you need to find is you need to find lots of them in one space. And if you find little ones next to big ones, you know you've got juveniles versus adults.
You got baby
So
dinosaurs.
yes, you know you've got baby dinosaurs, yes.
Yeah, fantastic. I mean, do they have an idea of approximately what the dimensions of this thing might have been then?
They do have some idea. They would know that it would be a medium-sized coelophysis-like dinosaur, so it would be probably about twice the size of a person in that sort of size.
Right.
In terms of when you look at the footprint, it's probably about twice the size of a human handprint, usually these footprints when I see them myself on the beach.
Will it have been a carnivore?
Yes, it would have been, and we know that because a carnivore usually has three toes. And what you can see from this one, from what I've seen on the news reports from the picture, is this looks very much like one of those. So it's more likely to be a smallish, and I say small in dinosaur terms, is actually quite big, a smallish kind of carnivore with those three toes. And those three toes usually have claws on the edge, on the their sort of little toes, and so for that, they're like talons on an eagle. So that's more like what you find in a rhapsid or something, one of these sort of giant birds. If it was going to be a vegetarian, a herbivore, it's more likely to be round like an elephant and much deeper down. Those animals would have been a lot larger, and they would have had these much larger footprints. So it's quite distinctive.
So, Aaron, what will it have fed on then? Other dinosaurs?
Yes. So, but the thing about this was that Coelophysis was probably feeding on those giant cow-like animals, the what we call paleontologists refer to as mammal-like reptiles, basically the intermediate between. So, if you can imagine these herds of cows, cow-like reptiles, moving around the world, and you can imagine these new, very fast dinosaurs were probably there waiting to pounce. So try and imagine that we're dealing with a kind of Triassic Serengeti here. Your mammal-like reptile cows are your wildebeest, and your coelophysis is your lion or your cheetah that's coming in to prey on the group of animals.
Oh, interesting. Well, I've never eaten a crocodile steak or an alligator steak. I don't know if it's possible to have an alligator steak, but were it possible to do so, is that approximately what one of these dinosaurs would have tasted like, or one of its meals would have tasted like? Does anyone have any idea?
Well, I can reveal in Australia I have had a crocodile burger,
Have you?
and it is a combination. I do have to say it's a combination between chicken and fish. It's richly very interesting when you're eating it because I'm thinking, this is halfway. Because we like to think of dinosaurs as being really halfway between a reptile and a bird, and we like to think of really reptiles themselves being halfway between a bird, and perhaps an amphibian, like a frog. Well, they taste like that. When you taste a crocodile burger, you are tasting something halfway between frog's legs and a chicken. And so it does make sense.
Would you have another one, Aaron?
No, I think the camel burger was better.
Okay, I see. Okay, great. Aaron, the area where it was walking, what will it have been like when the dinosaur walked through there?
Well, I mean, to have the footprints, it had to be a tidal area. So imagine a large marshland with lots of mud, because in order for that particular footprint to survive, it had to have been created by the dinosaur putting its foot down into the soft mud. And then within a few days, and I mean, even perhaps even a few hours, there had to be a change in the tide to cover mud over the footprint and preserve it. And the footprint will probably be a different type of sediment to the sediment covering it to allow it then to be compacted and preserved. So we know we're at the edge of a sort of coastal swamp. In terms of where we were on the edge of a continent, and we were at the edge of a series probably of forests. Now those forests would look a bit different from what we know today. So none of the trees that you're looking outside your window, no oaks, no chestnuts, because they hadn't evolved yet. They are flowering plants, angiosperms. We are dealing with a conifer forest world. So conifers and their relatives and cycads were the dominant plants, big plants in the world. And so as they're walking along that landscape, they would have looked towards mountains and they would have looked towards this forest of different plants. And it's those plants eventually that would become coal in some forms.
Oh, interesting. So that it's been underwater. Has it also been under ice any time in the millions of years since it was laid down?
Yes, there have been a series of ice age episodes throughout geological time. So we think about our last ice age, which finished around about 13,000 years ago. But there have been ice ages through the whole of geological time. So actually, at that time, although it was close to desert at that point, there may well have been that end of that period might have had small ice age episodes. But I suspect that many of the rocks of that area would have already have been buried deep under the crust before the next lot of sediments come in that have been formed by ice.
Oh, interesting. So what did the UK look like then? So it wasn't an island, is that right? It was a continent. And where were the other continents? Where was my country at that time? Where was the United States?
Well, I'm actually, we were all together. This was a very strange period in geological time. I mean, the Triassic was the beginning of the separation of Pangaea, the supercontinent. So the US and Britain actually were tucked up next to each other. So you can imagine that the British Isles was in the center of this continent, and it would have sat next to, because the Atlantic hadn't formed yet, next to Newfoundland and next to Labrador. And then just down the way was the United States. So at that time, it probably would have been quite a long hike, but you would have been able to walk literally from London to Minnesota.
Fantastic. That's fantastic, Aaron. We talk about London being Roman London being 20 feet down because the centuries accrete materials. Now, if this was millions of years ago, it must have been deep under stuff for a very long time. Is that right? I mean, did you say, I think you said right at the beginning, it's erosion has over the millions of years has brought this thing back to the surface. Is that right?
Yes, yeah, in fact it has. So what's happened is that it's been buried very it was actually buried very, very deep under the ground. And then what happened was, in the case of Britain, much of the sediments we see in England and Wales have actually been brought to the surface by the Alps. So what happened was, when we see a separation during the Jurassic period, where all these continents separate out, and we reach that time during the Cretaceous, or around the early Cretaceous period, which is around about 150 million to 120, and that time suddenly the separate continents then decide to get back together again. They start to move back together again. So we have out the world we now know today. And one of those was Africa, which used to be down near the South Pole. It then moves its way north, and as it does that, it then has a little microcontinent to the north of it, which we'd call Italy. And that and Africa slam into Europe, form the Alps, and the ripple effect comes north to Britain. And it means that the Britain kind of then has a ripple effect where it sort of bends and you have a whole series of folds, and it's that that then exposes all the rocks. So that's what we've seen in South Wales, is really the exposure of these deep, deep rocks from these geological tectonic forces.
May I say, Aaron, my jaw is just hanging open. I mean, what an extraordinary secondary world you mentally occupy. What must it be like wandering around in 21st century London, but having this vision and knowing the stuff that you know? It's just, this isn't a question. Well, I guess it is a question. What must it be like? But
it's a good question, because it's a parallel universe. It's like I live in a parallel universe, because I'm seeing the modern human world we live in. And I'm also seeing the bones of our geological landscape. So to me, Britain is like a skeleton. I look at different organs and parts, and each one represents a different story of geological time. And so when I'm looking over towards the south of England, I can see this, the Cretaceous rocks, the Cretaceous seas and what happened to them. And I look over towards Wales and I can see the area around there where you had these little dinosaurs living in caves. If they lived around Bristol, they would have lived in caves. And so it's like this sort of parallel world. And Bristol's a great place as well, South Wales and Bristol, because when I'm wandering through the gorge there, the Clifton Suspension Bridge gorge, I'm looking at two things there. I'm looking at the modern day landscape, but I'm also looking at this Triassic landscape that would have been these limestone caves sitting in a Triassic desert. So I'm seeing two of those. So it's almost like a double world. And, you know, we think about Doctor Who and traveling through time. Well, I'm doing it in my imagination when I'm going around Britain or even the world.
I think uniquely, I mean, we talk about London Walks guides, we walk around and we're seeing today's London, but we're also seeing maybe Tudor London or medieval London, which you also will be doing. But then you've got this third dimension, or this third world. That's remarkable. That's extraordinary. Let's go back to our dinosaur. Is he likely to get a name?
That's a good question, actually, because it can get two names. So we will probably be speculating on what the dinosaur name is. In fact, it's interesting to note that it might be the dinosaur that made this hasn't been discovered yet. It hasn't been found yet, because we're always finding dinosaurs every single year. We're always finding new species of fossils every single year. So we won't know for sure. But also, there is a whole parallel branch of paleontology just for footprints and for what we call trace fossils. It has its own parallel classification, and we actually have a species name for a trace fossil. It's called ichnology is the science, and we have ichnospecies and ichnogenera. So this particular species will gain a name of a kind of ichnogenera or ichnospecies for that dinosaur, and be compared with other footprints, because there's another fantastic dinosaur site which is later on the coast of Yorkshire, and being compared to other forms in the world. So science loves to classify, and we do have a classification system for it ready.
And is it likely to get a stage name, you know, be named after the little four-year-old girl or something like that?
Well, one of the pleasures in paleontology is you can do that. So if the paleontologist is nice, the person studying this particular specimen, and they wanted to publish it, then they could very well, if it was new, name it after little girl. And there is a famous example where a dinosaur paleontologist in Australia did name a dinosaur after his daughter.
Fantastic. How long did an individual dinosaur live if he or she died of old age? Do we know that?
That's something that's difficult to tell, because we have to rely upon living animals. And with dinosaurs, it's really, really tough, because dinosaurs are at the cusp of the birds, which tend to have quite a short lifespan, and reptiles, which have an enormous lifespan. So the way I say it, and I have this question a lot, is that I think during the time of the dinosaurs, the large sauropods, that's the ones with the long necks, they would have probably lived for quite some time. They could have been 70 or 80 years old if they are following their reptilian cousins. But I think the carnivores would have been quite short lifespans, 25 to 30 years. I think they would have been quite a, they wouldn't have lived as long as their other cousins.
And how big was their brain compared to, say, a human brain?
Still quite small. I mean, I think humans are unique in having an enormous brain. So if we think about what dinosaurs were dealing with, theropods, which is what we're dealing with here, their brains were actually quite large in comparison. So perhaps the size of a mug, or they would have been perhaps the size of your hand in terms of a brain. So reasonable, and that's because they needed to hunt. And that's the being a hunter is the important thing. Being able to hunt, perhaps hunt at night, you need a bigger brain to do that. But with the case of the vegetarian dinosaurs, they had tiny brains. The one that I like to talk about a lot is Stegosaurus, which has the brain the size of a walnut.
And I think you've already touched on this. Were they pack animals then?
I would have said that the case of these particular carnivores, they would have been would have hunted in packs. Yes, I would have said that. But again, it is a difficult one because it's only been 25 years that we've ever really come to terms with the fact that dinosaurs are birds and birds are dinosaurs. And so we are starting to moving away from this idea of solitary dinosaurs and towards this idea that they were flocks like birds. They were running, but they were flocking round the landscape. So again, it is very alien. We have to we find this difficult sometimes in paleontology to bring animals to life, and all we have is the present day to go on and geological evidence.
What about their senses, Aaron? I mean, it's common knowledge that humans have better eyesight than dogs. Dogs have a much, much more powerful sense of smell and sharper ears, and eagles have even sharper eyesight than humans do. Do we know about the dinosaurs' senses? What were their power senses?
Looking at the modern day birds, I think that they would have had the ability, as birds do, to have an incredible way of, if they're a carnivore, they would have been just like a bird of prey. And you can see a bird of prey have that ability to sort of scout a landscape and to look and to sense heat and to sense movement. One of the things you see in Jurassic Park that people use a lot, and many of the Hollywood movies, is they look at the fact that dinosaurs probably responded a lot to movement, but probably couldn't see that well. So again, they're getting that from birds. But that's an ongoing debate.
And how long did dinosaurs have to go? I mean, before the extinction I event. And can you tell me a little bit about the extinction event itself? Is that the right term?
Yes, the mass extinctions, we call them. So there are five great mass extinctions. The biggest one is not the one that killed the dinosaurs. That's number that was actually before the Triassic, before these dinosaur footprints. The dinosaurs would continue. They would flourish. And so we move from 210 to 65 million years ago. So we have to think about the fact that dinosaurs were on our planet for a significantly longer period of time than ourselves sitting here to only 65 million years ago when the dinosaurs disappeared. They're on our planet for a long time. And that mass extinction event, what remained through most of the 80s and the 90s, a total mystery until the discovery of the remains of a crater deep under the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico. And that was the smoking gun of what's often referred to as an asteroid. I would say probably in scale it was more like a comet in terms of its size, that it was a real bad hit. And it really hit the planet Earth. Now, the interesting thing about this thing was about 65 million years ago, the dinosaurs were going through a pretty bad time. They were going through a dino recession. They were going through a point where they were lower in diversity. They had ups and downs for the whole time, but this was a downer moment. Their diversity was relatively low, and they were quite spread across the planet by this time. So the continents are moving apart. And so when that comet went into the Earth, by this time it was hitting the dinosaurs when they were definitely on a downer. Now, one of the reasons why they were on a downer was because at this time we had an entire continent of volcanoes in India. You could say the whole of India was on fire. The whole of it was a huge plain of molten lava, the whole of India. And that was pumping carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. We had a super greenhouse, super CO2 world, dinosaurs and a downer, and then that comet goes in. And that comet resulted in a whole series of fires across the whole of the planet. So it was a pretty nasty time. Now, all you need to do then is you need to have what we refer to in ecology as ecosystem collapse. So in other words, the animals that the big carnivores, such as T-Rex and Triceratops, which was existing at that time, were trying to eat, disappear. They become extinct, and then everything else becomes extinct. And the only thing that survives from that ecosystem collapse is the things that eat death. So they include crocodiles, alligators, and those tiny little shrew-like mammals. All they had to do was scavenge the remains of everything. And so they were then able to survive the millions of years of this terrible time to appear out the other end.
You know, I think my jaw's hanging open again. I think you might be the most quotable human being I know. I mean, all of India was on fire, the things that eat death, etc., etc. Another question. The circumstances of this find are extraordinary. You know, a four-year-old girl, look, daddy, she says. You know, have there been other finds that are so happy, so lucky chance, so accidental?
The history of paleontology is full of them. And that's what I like about paleontology, is that you don't have to be the professor or the expert to find the amazing fossils. You can be anybody. And it says that one of our founding, the founding mother of our science, Mary Anning, was someone who didn't have a formal education, didn't go to university, but still became the expert of her beach in Lyme Regis and was able to make amazing discoveries. So yes, it's happened lots of times. So in the case, I can think of many examples. The best three examples I can think of is a local fossil collector in Lyme Regis and Dorset finding a whole dinosaur, which turned out to be the best preserved British dinosaur. An example in south of London, on the borders of Surrey and Sussex, where a man in the early 1980s, while walking his dog, found a claw of a dinosaur sticking out of a quarry, which would later become Baryonyx, a huge fish-eating dinosaur from the Cretaceous. And then the one I like to talk about, which is not just dinosaurs, but we go back to some of the earliest life forms on our planet. So we're going back to 700 million years ago. A schoolboy in Leicestershire, in a place called Charnwood Forest, Bradgate Park, discovered one of the oldest looking organisms on our planet. And that has led us to a whole series of science after that. So it's always going to happen. And that's the best thing about paleontology.
Fantastic. Let's come back to that footprint. Has that been visible for, say, the last 500 years?
The footprint?
Yeah, the one the little girl discovered.
It may well have only been exposed in terms of out of the rock, it may well have only been exposed for, it could be anything from a few days to hundreds of years. It depends who's seen it. I will say that some of these footprints can sit there for decades and they will be fine. There's one in the Isle of Skye, which I often take the students to, and it's still there every year. You can just see it. So these footprints could be exposed for years and we don't know they're there.
Where will the footprint go, Aaron?
Well, it depends, because it's a triple SI, a site of special scientific interest. So in theory, we can't do anything. We will have to leave it. Except if the Welsh equivalent of English Nature provide permission to remove the footprint because they believe that someone might do it, maybe a fossil collector might want to do it, then they might do it and it will go into the local museum, the National Museum of Wales. But it has to get permission to do that. But I'm assuming that the local geologists will be on to that. I think they'd want to make sure that something like this would be preserved in a museum.
And what will be involved in getting it off the beach? I mean, presumably it's already cordoned off like a crime area today. Is that right? And how will they preserve it? How will they move this thing?
They would need some sort of saw. They'd have to saw out the rock. I mean, the fact is that because it's on the coastline, over time it will get eroded and it will disappear. So it is in the best interest to get some sort of rock saw and remove it. And for the fact of conservation, that you don't want a member of the public to do the same. So the authorities there will be guarding it, and then they will probably be trying to remove it and put it into somewhere safe. In terms of conservation, it doesn't need much conservation. It's a rock that survived millions of years, and so it will need to be put in a nice sort of storeroom and looked after at a good temperature, but that's about it.
Fantastic. Okay, well, let's just end with a little bit about Aaron. You've got, I think, the best email address. Is it all right if I read it out? It's well, it's Aaron at a fossil hunter tours. That's a great email address. But you're not just a paleontologist. You're just a paleontologist. You're not just a narrow specialist. I mean, I've been on your tour of the city of Bath, and it's absolutely brilliant. It's so this is the virtual tour, so good that, well, as you know, Aaron, our Mary and my our best pals, when they're here from when they finally get here from Manhattan, we're hiring you for 2 days. You're going to show us around Bath. With shoe leather on pavement trip around Bath as opposed to armchair visiting in Bath, and then we're heading off to that is at Lyme Regis with you, so that'll be a 2 day trip. So can you maybe say a little bit about the your experience with Bath, how you became a Bath guide?
I became a Bath guide because I started living in the area at that time, and but I've always loved Bath because my confession is that for paleontology, the still what is unquestionably one of the best departments in the world, if not the best in the world, arguably, it's not Cambridge, it's Bristol, and so I was a student there in Bristol because that was and still is really the world centre in. Certainly the centre of Europe. And so I used to go to Bath a lot because I do have a very strong love of history and heritage. And I would say often probably even equal to paleontology in some respects. So I like both of them equally. And so guiding gives me opportunity to exercise that passion by taking the public around. And so I'm part of the honorary group of guides for Bath. So the ones that do it for nothing, as well as doing it for, so we do it for charity, really. We do it for the name of the mayor. And so that got me into guiding because I'm able to take people around the city. Of course, I'd love to take any group around the city and go even further afield and show Lyme Regis as well. So what I like to do often as well is combine the two together. So one thing I often do is urban geology. Which is when you walk around a city and you do both the fossils and the rocks of the buildings, and you also do the history of the buildings as well. So you combine the two worlds that I inhabit as well. And so for the Bath guides and for you as well, I mean, I have people who want to know more about the geology of Bath because Bath is made up of this lovely honey-coloured Jurassic limestone, which makes it really, really special.
And those Bath tours, let's stress this, they are genuinely those Mayor of Bath tours are genuinely free. They're not using The word free as a lure to hook people into an extraction operation. Is that right?
Yes, they are genuinely free. We have to refuse tips. So I like the fact I can separate out those two worlds, which is the blue badge, where we it's bespoke tours. You take where you go, I will take you where you want to go, and I will do a specialist tour on that one. From the highlights tour, which is what is strictly free for the mayor's guides.
That's fantastic. And how about for us for London Walk, some of I mean, you obviously are doing that Bath tour as a virtual tour, and well, the Natural History Museum. Can you say a little bit about that, and when your next ones are, et cetera, and any that might be in the pipeline?
Well, at the moment, every Thursday, I'm doing Mary Anning's Jurassic World and Natural History Museums. That combines the story of the Natural History Museum itself with one of focusing really on one of the galleries in the museum, which is the Marine Reptile Gallery, and to talk about the lady, the paleontologist who built up that collection, Mary Anning. And so I talk about those two themes as part of that talk. So that's every Thursdays at 6 p.m. And
And
then on
if,
a Sunday, sorry.
go ahead, Aaron.
And on a Sunday, I do my Bath tour every other week. And then I do ancient Britain, something archaeological. So very young for a paleontologist, really, but still interesting.
Right. And when normality returns, you'll be doing some shoe leather on pavement tours. That the dinosaur park, for example. Can you say something about that, please?
Oh yes, so this is something very close to my heart. So in Britain, the United Kingdom is the birthplace of geology, almost certainly, and specifically Scotland. And we are one of the places where paleontology as a science appeared. We rival France for that one. The French will have their claims. It's kind of both. And one of the in the earliest days of paleontology, so we're dealing back here in the 1840s, a series of scientists got together. They had found the first dinosaurs. So they had found Megalosaurus, Heliosaurus, Iguanodon, and Thecodontosaurus, which I mentioned earlier, because it's from the area of Bristol and Wales, the same age as the footprints. And what they did was they decided to create a series of models in the new Crystal Palace Park. Now, Crystal Palace itself, the Great Exhibition, had moved down there in the 1850s. And so they needed a new attraction, a new dinosaur park. In fact, it was the world's first dinosaur park in southeast London, an area close to my heart because my mother grew up in the area, so I'm from there. My grandparents are from that area, so it's an area I know very well. And so, what this park contains, what we thought dinosaurs looked like in 1853. So, of course, they're horribly wrong, but they are amazing and they are a fantastic sight. And they're under threat. They are very they're these concrete and brick models. So what I do in this virtual tour is I tell the story of how they were found, who these scientists were, how do they find these dinosaurs, how do they reconstruct them, how do people think about it, because this was a park the Victorians would have promenaded through. And then, but the fact that I'm actually working scientist, I bring it up to the present day. So what do we know now? And I mean literally now, in the last couple of years, about these dinosaurs now.
And I'd like to make the point that your tours are kid friendly. They're child friendly. I mean, sure, over the course of the last 30 minutes, you use some big scientific names, but the fact of the matter is, you work wonders with this subject with kids. So that's good to know. Finally, you've been in the press lately. The Telegraph, for example, and that's just about a starfish, I think. Is that right?
Yes, because so every paleontologist has a speciality, have an area of focus. Mine fits into two areas. I work on I don't really work on dinosaurs. That's a confession. I work on marine animals that lived at the same time as dinosaurs. So I do a lot of the Jurassic world. I look at animals that lived in the oceans around the dinosaurs. Perhaps the dinosaurs were eating them occasionally. They probably didn't want to. They weren't very tasty. But one of these areas I also work on, my kind of second area, is I look at the origin of animal life on our planet. So, and it's something the University of Cambridge has been involved with since the dawn of the science, since Adam Sedgwick, the scientist who taught Charles Darwin geology and fossils by taking him to Wales, started this research group that's really continued to the present day, looking at the origin of different animals on our planet. So we're not 210 million years ago. We are going back to 540, 545, 560, and up even as deep as 700 million years ago, to the origin of things that are completely normal to us. And they include things like corals and things like sponges and things that we have in our sea. And one of the things I've been doing, and I'm still doing, was looking at the origin of starfish, sea stars, and their cousins, the brittle stars, which they're very closely related to. And last week, I'm happy to say that finally a piece of research I've been working on for quite some time has been published, which is the origin, the oldest starfish in the fossil record, the beginning of the starfish fossil record, and probably one of the first modern animals that we recognize to appear on our planet. So what I like to say is, if you go back in your time machine back 485 million years ago, and you got out of your time machine on a landscape that had nothing on the land, okay, no plants there at all, it was a desert, there was nothing there, and you put your face in the sea, maybe you had a scuba gear on, or maybe you had snorkeling mask on, and you went into the sea, everything there would be alien to you, but not the starfish. You'd recognize them. And that is the discovery that I made and was published last week in the Telegraph and in the Royal Society publication, the journal.
Well, together we can put up something about that on the latest news, and we'll link to it from the Aaron bio on the page, et cetera, if people want to, know a bit more about that. So we're going to be here again, Aaron, because we're going to widen the focus a little bit, and we'll do one of those meet your guide interviews. As opposed to, this has been quite narrowly focused on the on that footprint and other dinosaur related matters. But this has been fantastic. And now, look, Aaron, I gotta go and get a vise and get my lower jaw back up and connected. This has been wonderful. Thanks very, very much indeed.
I'm glad you enjoyed it. It's always a pleasure to talk about paleontology. As you can see, I can talk all the time about it. I love to talk about it. So thank you very much
Yeah.
indeed.
Thanks a lot, Aaron. Fantastic.